I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show, and my guest today is Israeli journalist Gershon Gorenberg. The American audience is probably familiar with his work. He's a columnist at The American Prospect and at Open Zion at The Daily Beast, and his most recent book, which I think is a essential read about the situation in Israel and Palestine, is called The Unmaking of Israel, and it is now, if I'm not mistaken, out in paperback?
That's correct.
So, okay, well, today we're going to talk about the fallout and repercussions of the elections in Israel last week. And but I just want to note that the day that we're taping this is also the day of Chuck Hagel's confirmation hearings in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee, where he's being grilled by some Republicans about comments that he's made about the quote-unquote Jewish lobby or about Israel or about the situation in Israel and Palestine. And it seems interesting to me that these U.S. senators are so zeroed in on what Chuck Hagel thinks about Israel and trying to ferret out whether he's possibly anti-Israel. But I wonder, do Israelis even know or care about what Chuck Hagel has said in the past about Israel?
I don't think anybody outside of the inner circle of wonks has the foggiest idea what Chuck Hagel has said in the past or anything about him, except for maybe they may have noticed an item that he's a nominee to become American Defense Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
But even among the upper percentile of knowledgeable Israelis, I wouldn't embarrass them with a test for that. what I will say is that I haven't seen any public public comments, even off the record comments against him from Israeli sources. And there was a comment reported by the pretty hardline right-wing deputy foreign minister that he had no problem with Hagel. So I think this is one of those classic examples of you know, American politicians being eight times more Catholic than the Pope when it comes to Israel. I'm sorry for mixing my religious metaphors.
Oh, well, maybe we can just say eight times more pro-Israel than John Hagee.
Well, the problem is I don't want to put it that way because I don't think that those positions are particularly pro-Israel.
Air quotes on the pro-Israel.
What?
Air quotes on the pro-Israel.
Yes.
So, okay, well, let's turn now to Israel and talk about the election. So last week the election was held, but I think that the process of the election is probably unfamiliar to Americans because of the parliamentary system there. And so the process that has been started now, certain parties won a certain number of seats, and now the process that happens is the forming of coalitions and the figuring out who gets what ministries and so forth.
Right.
So where does that process stand, and how long do you think it's going to take to for all of that to get figured out, all the horse trading to happen?
Well, the process stands at the point that it's clear that Benjamin Netanyahu will be asked to form the next government, to be the next prime minister. He has to create a parliamentary majority by creating a coalition with other parties in order to do so. And that process could take 10 minutes after he officially gets the job, or it could go on for weeks. It's really difficult to predict that in advance. What happened in the election is that the side of the Knesset, of the parliament, made up of the right-wing and ultra-Orthodox parties, won a majority of one, 61 seats. So that guaranteed that Netanyahu would be the next prime minister, or would be asked to be the next prime minister. On the other hand, Netanyahu's Likud party sunk from 27 seats to 20 seats. His joint ticket with the Israel is Our Home party, headed by Avigdor Lieberman, went down from 42 seats total to 31. Netanyahu managed to get reelected while losing the election, essentially. There was a very significant drop-off in support for his party and for the bloc as a whole. And what that means is that the business of putting together a coalition is much more difficult for him. He needs several coalition partners to reach that magic number of 61, and each possible combination requires pushing into the background one major problem or another between the key parties in the coalition to be. He can't form a coalition, or that's not precisely correct. He would have an extremely difficult time forming a coalition without the centrist party, the new centrist party that's gotten a lot of attention since the election, led by former journalist Yair Lapid, which has only one seat less than his party does in the parliament. The only way he could form a coalition without Lapid's party is to take in all of the right-wing and ultra-Orthodox parties and then have a majority of one in the Knesset, which he doesn't want to do Netanyahu doesn't want to do that because he'll appear so, the coalition will appear so extreme and it will be so fragile because the moment one person walks out, it falls.
Right.
So he wants Lapid in. The problem is that, for Netanyahu, is that first of all, Lapid's party is demanding some form of ending the draft exemption for the ultra-Orthodox, which the ultra-Orthodox parties object to vehemently. And Lapid's party is also demanding that Israel return to peace negotiations with the Palestinians, which at a very early point could cause a crisis for the other right-wing religious party known as Jewish Home. So they have to figure out how much they're going to paper over mm-hmm. in order to create a coalition.
Well, let's
and
talk.
Whatever coalition they create will be rickety.
Let's talk about Lapid for a minute, because I think that, or for more than a minute, because I think that here the election results were interpreted as, look at that, the right was vanquished and the center won, because Lapid kind of came out of nowhere. I think a lot of people were expecting, based on the media coverage in the run-up to the election, that I think was based in part on polling that turned out to be inaccurate, a lot of people were expecting Naftali Bennett's party to make this huge surge, and he was sort of like the next big figure on the right in Israel. And that didn't happen, and so I think a lot of people were looking at it as a great victory for a centrist party, and that's Lapid's party, there is a future. And the question that keeps reverberating in my mind about that is, well, what is that future? And is it a future that's, the future that he proposes, is it doable given the configuration of, the probable configuration of the Knesset?
Well, first of all, I want to talk about what happened in the election itself.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, the victory of the center description is based on previous expectations. As you mentioned, there was an expectation that the right was going to have obviously a solid majority in the parliament, probably a larger majority, that was the buzz beforehand, than it did in the outgoing parliament. Naftali Bennett's party was expected to do well. And so when the election came in virtually tied, that was the first surprise. Now, part of this was in fact based on the polling. And I think that the words inaccurate and poll are inseparably joined in Israel. There are a lot of intrinsic problems built into polling, and unless Nate Silver wants to design a model 8 times more complicated than what he's got for American polling, it's hard to count on those polls. The one thing that was going on toward the end was a sign of a drop in support for the right and for Netanyahu. There's also a law in Israel that you can't publish polls within 5 days of the election, so whatever was happening in those last crucial days wasn't being reported, which mm-hmm. added to the surprise effect.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that if you break the parliament up into the major blocks, the center parties actually have a little bit less support than they did in the outgoing parliament. Lapid's party plus the 2 seats that the shattered remains of Kadima received, plus Tzipi Livni's 6 seats, altogether, parties labeled as centrist have 27 seats. In the last Knesset, Kadima by itself had 28. So basically, if you were just looking at the center, there's just been a rearrangement of seats in the middle. The only actual bloc in the Knesset which gained in this election, interestingly enough, was the parties of the left, Labor and Meretz, who gained seats. Not enough to take power, but that's where the electorate shifted to if you look at the overall picture. So that's a very significant fact, and that's what leaves Netanyahu so weakened. What does Lapid stand for?
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can see right now, an interesting collection of very, very shallow statements, many of which are designed to please everybody. How those promises will play out once his party is in government is a question dependent not only on the coalition, but on what the different members of his party understand its platform to be, and whether they have any ability to govern. Just to give you, the most obvious example, Lapid insisted that Israel must return to negotiations with the Palestinians. He also says that Israel must hold on to the major settlement blocks, including the settlement of Ariel, which is fairly deep into the West Bank. And his platform states that, repeats the narrative that the breakdown in negotiations is pretty much wholly at fault, that the Palestinians are almost wholly at fault with that. Well, this is an unrealistic combination positions, and it will be tested if, in fact, he succeeds in getting Israel to return to the negotiating table. It will very quickly become clear, as it did to Ehud Olmert in 2008, that you either have to move from that position or you aren't going to negotiate, and you're not going to get to a peace agreement.
But what would Lapid actually have the political power or clout behind him to actually press for that? I mean, so would he have to be given become foreign minister to be able to be in a position to do that? Or under what circumstances do you think he would even be placed in a position that was even feasible, assuming that his theoretical positioning on this is feasible?
Well, the position that he has to be on is basically saying this is a make-or-break issue for holding the parliament, for holding the coalition together. The foreign minister, historically in Israel, has not been, depending on who's in the office, but has not always, I don't think in most of the instances, been the central figure in such negotiations. relations with the United States and peace negotiations, which are the most critical foreign policy issues in Israel, are usually run out of the prime minister's office. Mm-hmm. So you could say Lapid has no influence over this and that he's just going to end up providing a fig leaf for Netanyahu, that Israel will get an even more glib spokesman than Netanyahu, and Lapid will talk nice while Netanyahu fails to move. And that's what will happen unless Lapid says, you have to negotiate seriously or we're walking out, or we have to agree on who the key negotiator is, or you send somebody from our choice of negotiator to the table. Unless he makes that a make-or-break condition, unless he's willing to walk out the moment that that Netanyahu shows that he's not really interested in making any progress, mm-hmm. He's not going to have any influence. And if he's not willing to walk out, having the foreign minister isn't going to help in the least.
Okay. So, but what I'm hearing you say is that he really has to stand firm, but his public statements so far on this issue, stand firm on walking out of the coalition if negotiations don't start again, but it seems like from his public statements that he's really not that committed to it because he's made these statements that don't really hold together or are contradictory with each other.
I would say, put it differently, I think he's expressed a commitment to contradictory stance. He may be sincere about that. He may simply have taken the position that is most likely to appeal to the center of the Israeli electorate, which is polling of all sorts of questions has shown that there's a broad swath of the Israeli electorate in the middle who believe that you have to go back to negotiations and don't trust the Palestinians, that we have to make peace, but we can't divide Jerusalem or give up the major settlements. And they're conflicted. Mm-hmm. And Lapid managed to express their conflictedness perfectly in his election campaign. Well, if you were writing an editorial for Haaretz and you did that, or for the New York Times, that would be fine, right? But when you actually have to carry it out, you have to start choosing between those positions. And so the test is, having gotten into government, right now Lapid is saying that Lapid and the people in his party are saying they will not enter a government unless Netanyahu sets a date for when they're going back to the negotiating table. Okay, that's a good start. Once you go back to the negotiating table, you're going to sit down at the table and Mahmoud Abbas or his stand-in as a representative of the Palestinians is going to say, we want a peace agreement based on the 1967 borders with small one-to-one exchanges of territory. We want to start where Olmert left off in 2008, which means an internationalization of the old city. That's what they're going to hear. And there is a partner for that deal. There is not a partner for the deal that is laid out in Lapid's platform.
Right.
So, okay, that's what happens after elections, right? You know, you promise the world to everybody.
Right. And then you have to choose
who to disappoint.
But how does that possibly hold together with a right-wing coalition?
That's a lovely question. I really don't... If he stands up for that, and the moment that it requires any kind of action or public commitment, for instance, the Jewish Home Party would either walk out or splinter.
Right.
Because the Jewish Home Party is in itself a fusion of a right-wing and another much more right-wing, or at least somewhat more right-wing party. Every political party is a coalition within itself, and part of the Jewish Homes Coalition, at least part of it, will not tolerate, say, any restriction on settlement building, even restriction to the settlements that Lapid thinks that Israel can keep. The hardliners in that party will not even be likely to allow a lip service to the idea of mm-hmm. a two-state solution.
Right.
What happens if there's real negotiations? I don't know. I think that this is an interesting laboratory experiment, and that John Kerry should put on a white lab coat and immediately step into the laboratory and run a test.
Well,
maybe with his doctoral advisor, Barack Obama, in the lab with him.
Well, but what do you think they can do, Kerry and Obama?
Well, if they think that they have to make a deal with this government, and they think in American terms that this government is going to be there for 4 years, they're not going to get a deal with this government. But if they're thinking in terms of a fluid political situation, then there's much more that can be done, because a coalition collapsing could be seen as a good starting point rather than a good ending point. In other words, on a wider level, I think that one of the mistakes of American negotiations in the past has been a focus too tightly on officials and politicians without paying attention to the fact that it's public support for a process that is likely to make the greatest difference. So American diplomacy, first of all, has to address the Israeli public as well as the politicians, and if there is a sense more widely that there's a real deal on the table, that there's an actual chance of getting peace, well, I think that Netanyahu would have the choice of facing an electorate even less happy with him
than last week,
mm-hmm. or trying not to face that electorate by making concessions. If there's one constitutional issue in Israel, which has no constitution, it's that I don't think that Netanyahu is constitutionally capable of making those concessions. So, okay, so the government would fall. All right.
So,
I mean, from an Israeli point of view, from an Israeli point of view, American politics looks very strange because it's a league with only two teams in it, and each time they play a game, there's only one inning. But Israeli politics doesn't work that way.
So, but hypothetically, if this happened, and it seems difficult to imagine for me at this point, actually, the Obama administration would put that kind of pressure towards the negotiating table at all. But maybe I can be surprised. But let's hypothetically say that happened and it did cause the government to fall. And what do you think that would move the Israeli electorate to elect a government that was more committed to making peace? Or do you think the electorate is not there?
Well, I think that, well, first of all, these are estimations.
Yeah.
I don't make predictions.
Sure.
I think that last week we saw an election in which the prime minister ran unopposed, did his best to squelch this issue, and the electorate still moved significantly leftward. And I think this is in keeping with a wider pattern in Israeli politics that the pendulum swings back and forth, as it has been doing since 1992. And that the idea that the Israeli electorate as a whole is moving steadily rightward, that the ship is sinking on the right side, that hypothesis doesn't stand up either to a longer view of history over the last 20 years or to a shorter view of history over the last 20 days.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because I think that idea that the Israeli electorate has been moving in this right-wing direction is a proposition that is definitely out there and talked about, among American talking heads who cover this issue or write about this issue.
Okay, so that was a one election supposition. In 2009, the right won a majority, and Netanyahu took office. In 2006, Ehud Olmert, a recovering right-winger, but now committed to the idea of an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank, ran on a platform of Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank, and the center and left won a larger majority in the Knesset. The election before that, in 2003, Ariel Sharon, taking a more hawkish line at that time, won the election. All right, in 1999, Ehud Barak, saying that he was negotiating peace, won the election. If you call this a trend line, it's only by shortening the scope of vision to such a brief period that you can squeeze a trend out of it.
Well, I think that when you look at it, maybe not so much as a trend, but even as the short-term spurt, developments have been alarming. Even as a short-term spurt from since 2009, if you want to look at it in the whole scheme of things. So I think that to an outsider who sees stagnation in terms of the peace process, continuing building of settlements, and no possibility. It doesn't seem that a withdrawal is at all in sight. And then you had over the past few years, the outlandish racist statements by somebody like Lieberman, the attacks on the left-wing NGOs. And so to an outsider, who's not thinking about it in terms of historical trend lines, but just looking at the more immediate events, the inclination is, wow, there's a real tilt to the right. But then you have Lapid winning, and then it's like, oh, well, maybe the right was not so much in control, and here's this center, and everybody loves the center because it sort of splits the difference. But
no, it promises that you can have your cake and eat it.
None of that ever happens.
Right.
But so I think that for Americans who watch this, you watch it and you wonder, okay, so, the right wingers seem to have, if not the upper hand, they have, their position is the one that's locked in right now. No freezing of settlements and no withdrawals. And so it's hard to see where the resistance to that is actually coming from.
Okay, I would put it differently. There is a problem of inertia or of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And in developments, not in the parliament, but on the ground,
mm-hmm.
in terms of settlement building, in terms of settler support within key bureaucracies, in terms of not negotiating, the momentum has been with the right. And so in order to change directions, you don't have to merely make a turn. You have to exert much more energy because the actual machinery of state has been working according to the rights program. And that change is desperately important and urgent because, well, for one thing, a failure to negotiate could destroy Abbas's support among Palestinians, which is predicated on the idea that Palestinians can get a state through negotiations. So in terms of those things, if you're saying, well, let's look at the short term because the short term is really important because things could change quickly, that's true. In terms of the electoral situation, I don't think it's true that there's a right-wing drift. I think there's deep divisions, and mm-hmm. I think there's people, as I said, in the middle who would prefer not to decide until they're pushed to.
Right.
And I also think that a concrete peace deal is much easier to support than an abstract one. Because what happens when the idea of two states and a peace deal is abstract is Israelis, or for that matter in a different constellation, Palestinians are told, this is very much what you have to give up, and you might get something in return, but we're not quite sure what. Okay? But when the thing that you're going to get is sharper and clearer, then it's easier to decide that you want to pay that price because you're going to make other gains that are important to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the question is whether there's a push for negotiations. And mm-hmm. there's, three or four possible, say three and a half possible directions that push can come from. Either Abbas can find some way to launch a new public initiative with international support saying, yes, you know, Mr. Netanyahu, I see you have a new government and that you're dedicated to returning to negotiations. I want to come to the Knesset tomorrow to, you know, explain why we should make peace now. That's one approach. Second thing that could push negotiations, as I said before, is Lapid's party really sticking to it, saying, we want to sit down now, we want to do what's necessary. If not, you know, we're flying high, we're willing to face the electorate again on that. A third possibility is that, as on other issues, where Obama has seemed more assertive in his second term, than we learned to expect in his first term.
It's true. On domestic issues here, he has been.
Okay. So, you know, his foreign policy team is being approved now. I think, I would guess the results of these elections were also a surprise in the top foreign policy circles in the United States, unless they had some secret pollster out there who was, you know, giving them different, I highly doubt it.
Yeah.
And so they have a new situation. Yeah. They have to decide whether, given the new constellation, given Netanyahu's internal weakness and his dependence on Lapid, whether it's worth launching an initiative. And
right.
if they do so, they could alter the state of things. And the half is that there's been talk of Europe engaging in such an initiative. The reason I say half is that, first of all, Europe's internal problems are far more complex than American domestic issues. And second of all, even though Europe is Israel's biggest trading partner, its diplomatic clout is smaller here. But that's also a possibility. So if one of those three and a half things happen, Netanyahu gets tested. If not, he can keep a coalition together on that issue. That's before we get to the issue of drafting the ultra-Orthodox.
Right. I mean, there is that issue. That's another big issue that could pull a coalition apart. And Lapid is for drafting the ultra-Orthodox into the military. Is that right?
He's got this program which is aimed at bringing the ultra-Orthodox into a universal draft. His platform says that what would happen is that everybody 18 years old would have to report to the draft office. The army would then decide how many of them it needed, and everybody else would have to do some sort of alternative civilian service. There's a lot of practical and problems with that. There's a question in principle of whether drafting people for civilian service is as justifiable in a democratic system as drafting people for military service. But the biggest question is, can you put together a coalition which will support such a program? If Netanyahu is not leaning on Jewish Home to put together his coalition, then he needs the support of the ultra-Orthodox, at least the larger ultra-Orthodox party, Shas. And, can somebody, come up with the grand compromise that will either solve or paper over that problem? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well,
talk to me after you get done with the debt issue in the United States.
right. Well, let's talk about the Israeli left. So there's a new think tank, a relatively new think tank, Molad, in Israel. And one of their, I don't know what his position is, one of their analysts, Avner Inbar, wrote an election analysis in which he says that there really is no center and that the left is thriving. And that Molad's public opinion polling, which is in the realm of the unreliable public opinion polling, shows that there's, you know, a good chunk of Israelis who are very left-wing on economic issues, on two-state solution. I mean, I know you've read the piece. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, that the analysis is a strong one. When I said that polling is innately inaccurate in Israel, I'm really referring to electoral polling. Because, for instance, one thing that happens in an Israeli electoral poll is you ask people who they're voting for, and they say they're undecided. But they're undecided between 15 parties. And the reason that they're undecided in this last election could very easily have been that they're undecided between four or five different parties on the center and the left. But they're going to vote, and they're going to vote for one of those parties. So if you assume that the undecideds don't count, you get everything wrong. Okay? There's a pattern of polling which shows that a strong majority of the Israeli public wants to go back to negotiations. There's a pattern of polling that shows that a large part of the people who want to go back to negotiations don't believe that they're going to succeed. Logically, that's not a consistent position, mm-hmm. but based on experience and conditions, sometimes people believe contradictory things until they have to make a decision. But the basic idea that Malad's report is presenting, which is the shift, actually, the people who gained from this last election were on the left. I've already said I think that that's true. The centrist position has something basically untenable about it. But it is reasonable to presume that anybody who didn't want to go back to negotiations would have had a hard time voting for Lapid. So more support has swung toward that position. It is not a time for wringing of hands and for despair. And I think that that's, you know, the bottom line point that comes out of that analysis.
And so you're not wringing your hands or despairing?
No. But first of all, I think I think one of the reasons that, you know, to go back to your question, is Obama going to do this? I think one of the reasons for the atmosphere of despair about Middle East negotiations in Washington is that despair lets you off the hook. Right? Mm-hmm. This disease is terminal. We can't do anything about it. You know, so stop trying new things.
Well, in addition to that, it lets you off the hook of getting into the whole discussion or flame war about whether you're pro-Israel or not. Right? that's the litmus test here, for Chuck Hagel or, any politician. They all have to set, they all have to demonstrate that they're pro-Israel. And so if you're despairing, then you don't even have to, like, enter the waters to, if you're a politician.
Well, you take a particular kind of despair, which is the brand of despair sold by the Israeli right, which is there's no point in going back to negotiations because there's nobody to talk to. That is,
and
for the Israeli right, that's a
that's not despair,
a point
though.
Of ideology dressed up as a practical problem.
Right. I mean, that's the way they want it to be. And so they...
Right. We don't want to go back to negotiations, so it's easier, it's nicer to say in public that there's nobody to talk to. And in a sense, they're right. For the kind of agreement that they'd be willing to make, there's no partner.
Right.
For,
but the problem is that the kind of agreement that they want to make is a problem.
Yeah. You know, I mean, for a quote, Palestinian state, unquote, that's a bunch of little enclaves with limited powers and having to go through tunnels to get from one section to the next, and Israel controlling its borders, yeah, okay, there's no partner for that.
Right.
So if that's your bottom line, you can stand up and say, there's no partner to talk to. And if you don't want to upset this extremely vocal, if you don't want to worry about getting labeled that you're not pro-Israel in Washington, apparently it's easier to take that position.
Mm-hmm.
I it would be healthy to even say pro-Israel position. That actually has Israel's best interests in mind and not showing how hawkish you can be.
Right, right. But I don't think... I mean, I think that I think a lot of people view the Hagel nomination as being a baby step, a real baby step in that direction. Or in my view, I mean, I think some people may have seen it as more than a baby step in that direction, that it was like a real test of whether, a Democratic appointee would stand up to these charges of being anti-Israel launched at them by Republicans and neoconservatives. And I think today's hearing, which, I know you didn't see it, but I think that it's hard to say how the American public is going to view whether who won, quote unquote, in those hearing standoffs, and whether Hagel will be seen as having positively defended himself against these charges brought by, Senator Inhofe or Senator Cruz or any of the others. And so I think that we haven't gotten there yet. I think we've continued in this Hagel hearing, we've continued to see that became the dominant issue. The dominant issue, I mean, he did get asked questions that pertain to what the Secretary of Defense actually does, because the Secretary of Defense doesn't negotiate, you know, that's going to be John Kerry's job, you know, to deal with this issue. It's not going to be, if Chuck Hagel becomes Defense Secretary, this is not going to be part of his dossier. And he, you know, I think he tried to say all the right things. You know, he said that, you know, okay, we stand with Israel, we're going to continue to fund Iron Dome for them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think just the atmospherics created by these questions that were being addressed to him on these, are you really pro-Israel enough? And really, you know, maybe we should be questioning your loyalty, prove that, you know, Washington hasn't moved beyond that yet. And because the media likes those kind of fireworks, because it's fun to report on and it's, you know, and, you know, more interesting than discussing, you know, missile systems and whether they're going to continue to fund those or not, or the Pentagon budget or whatever, you know, there's going to continue to be an appetite for that. And I think the Republicans see that there's an appetite for that in their base. I mean, you saw this week John Hagee and Christians United for Israel. I mean, I know that, you know, AIPAC sat out this one, and there were a lot of Jewish advocacy groups that sat it out and didn't take a position and weren't going to the Hill to talk to the senators about Hagel. But Hagee brought a few hundred pastors to Capitol Hill to talk to senators about Hagel. And so when you think about that, that's who they were listening to, and that's who they were being trying to be persuaded, that who were trying to persuade them that Hagel had some questionable bona fides on Israel. You know, I think it just goes to show you that, A, you know, we really haven't, you know, moved out of that box very far, if at all.
Well, I think that you just described the move. If AIPAC decided to sit this out, then a normally very feisty organization decided that this was a fight that was either not justified or not winnable, and either way that's
or not worth it if Hagel was otherwise
one way
hurt.
Or another, the strategists within AIPAC and within other organizations decided not to do this. So who, I mean, if you're a Democratic senator, if you're part of the Senate majority, John Hagee isn't voting for you anyway, right?
Oh yeah, that's
so
true.
Okay, I mean, you know, in other words, like it, I don't know, people are talking about you know, a lot of other issues within the American political frame where those people also aren't voting for you. You know, Texas did not vote, you know, Democratic in the last presidential election. So the effect of this vote is to produce the curious effect that kind of pro-Israel stand gets identified as being equivalent to, I don't know, John Hagee, the last battle against gay marriage, I don't know what else, you know, the agenda of the theocons, then that actually frees up a lot of people to say, okay, well, you know, they're not going to vote for us anyway, so we might as well move ahead.
Well, I do think, though, you know, there is a lot of what we call dark money, you know, money from unknown sources being poured into, you know, these ad campaigns and so on, which really don't influence individual voters, really. People don't really pay attention to them, but they're meant to serve as a warning to senators. I think that in terms
that
of political...
Sheldon Adelson, who decided November's
right.
elections
I mean, I think
in the United States and January's elections in Israel might be out to get you.
Yes.
I mean, at this point, it seems like a winning combination.
Well,
but still,
I think that AIPAC is more politically savvy than CUFI, because I think that an organization like CUFI wins by losing. Okay? They win even when they lose. Because if they lose, they can still have their complex about, you know, oh, you know, it's us against the world that doesn't care about Israel the way that we do.
Right.
AIPAC is much more, as I said, savvy, smart, more of a Washington insider. You know, they're about politics. CUFI likes to say it's about politics, but it's really about theology. And so I think that that Hagee and CUFI don't really see that they have anything to lose if they pour all this effort into opposing Hagel and he still gets confirmed. I think that AIPAC would view that as an embarrassment to have waded into that fight and then he gets confirmed anyway. And so I think that that has a lot to do with it. But I still think that there's a lot of that stuff under the surface. And I think when you see Democratic senators from, you know, more heavily Jewish states like Senator Gillibrand today, you see that there's still that concern about, you know, I need to ask Chuck Hagel about his quote-unquote pro-Israel bona fides.
Look, I'm not saying that this issue is going away, but I think that the combination of the fact that in this particular fight, some of the key groups decided it was politically wise to stay out, and the fact that even while Netanyahu remains prime minister, he's clearly politically weakened,
mm-hmm.
Are things that, you know, are openings. They're openings in terms of the American political scene, and they're openings in terms of diplomacy.
I don't disagree, but
Benjamin Netanyahu is not king. He is, or if he is, he's, you know, he's a king of a collapsing kingdom in terms of his political situation.
Mm-hmm.
So attuning you know, your political stance to the fact that you have to cure for Benjamin Netanyahu isn't even a smart move, because you don't know how long he's going to be around, and he's power sharing now. So, look, I'm not saying that this, you know, that this pressure isn't there in Washington, and I'm not seeking to explain Washington.
Right.
I'm saying that the potential for engaging in such efforts now is greater than when Netanyahu had a more solid majority in the Knesset and wasn't seen as a loser by everybody, including most members of his own party.
Right.
So, you know, will they test it? I don't know. I mean,
well,
you know, I wouldn't have thought that anybody would have tested, you know, gun control. Right. So who knows?
Yeah, no, I mean, I do have to say that Obama has been surprisingly out front on the gun control issue and on the immigration issue, another, you know, highly contested issue here in the state. And he has appeared willing to really fight the fight. So, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it's a shame that he can't recommend. I mean, I understand that he can't, because it's impossible. It's politically beyond hope. But it's a shame he can't suggest Israel's gun laws, because then only about, I don't know, some tiny fraction of Americans would be eligible for gun licenses. But okay, that's another daydream for another time. But he has been feistier since November. So I'm not saying that I'm betting on something happening from Washington. Kerry claimed that there would be something without saying quite what.
Right.
We'll see. You know, the question is, what would happen if he tried it? I think conditions are better.
Right, right. Well, I think the takeaway of don't despair is a pretty good note to end on.
Okay.
So,
okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Well, thank you so much for doing it. It was a good discussion.